Alright, so today we're going to cover the beginning of the Ten Commandments. I will actually be your instructor for the next four sessions. And the reason for that is because when Father and I decide on who's going to cover what, we do so according to our area of knowledge or specialty. And one of my areas of concentration and studies is moral theology, and the Ten Commandments are part of the heart of the moral theology of the church, understandably. So this is sort of my area that Father said. He said, I know you know more about this than I do. And Father's area is more of spiritual theology. So when it comes to things like prayer, he is definitely much more well-versed in sort of the movements in the spirit in regards to prayer. My area is here in moral theology. So we're going to go through all the Ten Commandments, 1 through 10, and then from each of them, hopefully, we'll be able to extrapolate a little bit more about the moral life and what we ought to know about living a life in Christ. Now, what I wanted to do first is just give you some basic ideas in the church's mind about some notions that are important to keep in mind when we're talking about the law, okay, or the moral law. All right, the first thing I want to put up here is just this word, freedom. And I want to talk a little bit about what this means. When you see this word in moral theology or in Catholic speak, for that matter, this notion, this word, has a very different meaning than what the word means to most people that you would meet today in the secular arena. All right, and it's a very important distinction, because if you don't get this distinction, then you'll always see the moral law of Christ as pronounced by the church as somehow being restrictive or something that's intended to make our lives difficult. All right. So that's kind of the prevailing thought of a lot of people in regards to the moral law of the church, right? The church has all these teachings, too many rules, too many regulations. I just want to be free, right? And if I can get away from all the teachings and away from all the rules, and if there are no rules, then I'm really free, right? And I'll give you an example. Some years ago, 7-Eleven, this is about 25, 30 years ago now, 7-Eleven ran a very, very popular ad campaign. And it's still very much at the heart of even how soft drinks are served around the world today. And we'll talk a little bit about marketing, maybe to help understand notions of freedom. They embarked on a program called Freedom of Choice. Okay? Now, Freedom of Choice campaign. Now, what does that mean? It meant, 30 years ago, this is revolutionary in soda making and soda distribution. For the first time ever, you could go to the 7-Eleven, all right? And before then, you had to ask for an attendant to make your drink for you, all right? The person behind the counter made your drink. But 7-Eleven did something very novel. They moved the fountain machine outside the counter and put it in the retail space, all right? Now, for the first time ever, you were not dependent upon anyone else to make your own drink. You could get a small gulp, a medium-sized gulp, a big gulp, or a super big gulp. Okay? Anyone ever seen this machine before? Okay, you go to any fast food restaurant now, right? But you make your own drink. They just give you a cup, right? And I have no idea why anyone buys a large cup when you can always buy a small cup and keep going back. I don't know why they do that, but maybe they're taking it on the road. Maybe they want to have bigger capacity on the way out. Man, that makes sense for a few cents more. Okay, now what did 7-Eleven do in their ad campaign about freedom? They said, no one can tell you how to make your drink. You are free to make your drink. So you decide how much ice there is. You decide what the proportion is to Sprite, and if you like to mix it with something else. Okay? So what happens is freedom becomes understood, and this is just an expression of something we kind of just accept now. You are free if no one can tell you what to do, when to do it, how to do it, and with whom to do it. That's what we mean today by freedom. All right? So we get all kinds of interesting things out there in the world, right? Look at how we use it. So, mainstreaming now pornography. Under what? Freedom of expression. The government can't tell me that that's indecent. Nothing's indecent under this understanding of freedom. Okay? This is not the classical understanding of freedom, nor is it the kind of freedom that the founders of this country envisioned when they gave us all of these different freedoms. Freedom actually is not merely the capacity to do what we want. Okay? Freedom, in the classical definition, is the capacity to do as we ought. Big difference. Not merely the capacity to do what we want. That's called caprice. That's not freedom. That's just called being whimsical or capricious. I can do whatever I want, where I want, with whom I want, and therefore I am free. This is a definition that most Americans understand by freedom now. That's what it means to be free. But in the classical understanding of freedom that the fathers of this country understood, it was the second one here. Okay, this is it right here. Not to do merely what I want, but to do what I ought. Right? Now, to do what I ought, that's an interesting term, isn't it? Because it implies that there is something I ought to do. Right? That I'm not just some wild being out there who can just do whatever I please without consequence. Although there are many people who try to live their lives as if that's true. Right? For example, if you take a married couple and the bride, they have three children, but the bride insists on living like a bachelorette. Right? She goes out drinking with her office mates on Friday nights after work. She goes away on the weekend on trips, does this, you know, hang out with the kids, right? Okay, you might think this unconscionable. Trust me, I hear confessions. Okay? All right, it's out there. Okay? So people think that, you know, if I'm not bound by anything, I'm free. The church, taking the classical definition, says no. Really, if you think about the moral law of the church, one of the great saints once said, the law of Christ tells us less about what we cannot do as much as it reveals all the things we are free to do. Right? It tells us less about what we're restricted to do and much more about the good we can choose. Now, when people look at the moral law of the church and they look at the law of Christ and they all they see is these rules, thou shalt not, right? They get turned away because they say, this is restricting my freedom. This is somehow restricting my true self. Where the church says, no, actually, if you follow God's law, you will find a way to live according to His plan and design for your life. You can choose not to live that way, but there are consequences, as we know. Heaven and hell. Right? So there's heaven or hell to pay. Okay? So the idea here is when we're talking about these different commandments that we're going to go through, understand what we're talking about here. We're not just talking about merely thou shalt not. Right? I mean, what does fallen human nature always do? If I say thou shalt not, you will find a way to get around it. Right? It's the apostolate of the loophole. Okay? We're trying to find a way around it. Right? So, for example, I'll give you one just very small example, but in the liturgy of the church, okay? Now, what's the American mentality in terms of laws? I can, unless it says I can't. Right? Think about right turn on red. I can, unless it says I can't. No turn on red, right? Okay. That is not the Roman way of thinking about law. Right? The Roman way is, let's say in terms of liturgy, so I'll give you an example. I In the American sensibility, let's see here. Blessings of children during communion. Ah, yes. Point of contention among many people in the parish. They want Father to bless their child when they bring their child up for communion. So what do they say? Father, it doesn't say you can't, therefore you can. No, that's not the Roman way of reading liturgical law. The Roman way of reading liturgical law is, it is forbidden unless I am commanded to do something. And the church tells me is specifically what I'm supposed to do during communion, distribute communion, not bless children. See how the difference is? Okay, so people say, well, Father, it doesn't say you can't, so I'm sure you can. Well, you know what? I said, sweetheart, it doesn't say that I can't do jumping jacks and cartwheels down the aisle in the opening procession. Does it? You use that logic, then I can just do any old thing I like. You know, we can pick whatever music we like, and I can just strut down the aisle and high-five everybody, you know, and get everybody juiced up, right? Okay, and we start playing, like, you know, arena music, you know, get people psyched up before the game, you know, let's get ready to rumble, right? That's, you know, okay, doesn't say I can't. That's not the way of the church. The way the church says it is forbidden unless it is specifically mandated to do something. And what is mandated to do is given to me specifically. Just do this. That's all, Father. Just do this. No creativity, no innovation. It's not your prayer. It belongs to the church. Don't be arrogant and do your own thing. Follow the rules. Right? It's a humility just to do what the church says. All right, and sometimes when I find my peers out there doing all kinds of Saturday Night Fever down the aisle and who knows what else, okay, I'm thinking to myself, what are you doing? Okay, you don't understand what you ought to be doing because you don't understand who you are. Okay, a servant of the liturgy, not its innovator, not its developer. Okay, so you see the notions of freedom? One priest might say, oh no, I'm free to do it because it doesn't say I can't. Okay, and I'm like, no, you're only free to do what you're supposed to do, and that's what's given in the books. Follow the rules. Be obedient. Okay. Adam and Eve taught us a very, very bad thing, disobedience, and we have still not figured it out. Okay, now, so let's think about, we have freedom and the law down. Let's think about this for a second. This is in Matthew 19. This is the story of the rich young man, Matthew 19, verses 16 to 19. If you have your Bibles, if you don't, it's okay. Matthew 19, 16 to 19. This is the story of the rich young man. The rich young man goes up to Jesus and says, Teacher, what good deed or what must I do to have eternal life? Okay? What must I do to inherit eternal life? That's what the rich young man wants to do. Right? And Jesus says, okay, you shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. Honor your father and your mother. Right? You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Okay. And what does the rich young man say? Master, all of these I have observed from my youth. Now let's think about that. Let's just stop right there. Let's just think about that for a second. That's pretty impressive. All of these, the commandments, I have kept from my youth. Pretty good. In fact, most people would say, living saint. If he is telling Jesus the truth, I have kept all the commandments from my youth. Living saint. He's done it all. All right? Then Jesus says, there is one more thing you are lacking. And which my young man's surprised. What could that possibly be? Right? Jesus says, if you choose to be perfect, if you want to be perfect, go, sell everything you have, and come follow me. If you wish to be perfect, go, sell everything you have, and come follow me. All right. What does the rich young man do? He goes away sad because he had many possessions. Who knows who the rich young man could have been? He could have been one of the apostles. Never know. You never know, right? We don't know. We never will know. In fact, isn't it interesting to know? We don't even know his name. We don't even know his name. This is someone who's kept the commandments from his youth. I mean, how many of us could say we've kept the commandments from our youth? All of the commandments from our entire life. I mean, come on. Right? All right. We don't even know his name. The fact that Matthew deletes or omits his name from the narrative is significant. All right? So, what does this mean then? Well, this is a good way to begin an understanding of the commandments. The commandments are the baseline. They are the basic, foundational, that's the minimum. The commandments are the bare minimum of the moral life. Okay? The Beatitudes, all right, are like the ceiling which with an infinite horizon. Not a glass ceiling. You can't go through a glass ceiling. Okay? But it's a ceiling, sort of like a dome, but with infinite depth, infinite height. All right? And then along the sides, the pillars of the house to keep it standing are the evangelical councils. The evangelical councils are what Jesus teaches here. Go and sell everything you have and come follow me. They are faith, hope, and charity. All right? That's the moral structure of the house of the moral law of the Catholic Church. The Ten Commandments are the floor, the basement, the foundation. The Beatitudes form this ceiling with an infinite horizon. And then the walls are the doctrines of the church and the evangelical councils. Faith, hope, and charity. All right. Now, I just want to put these basic ideas up on the board first, even before we talk about the commandments proper, because if we don't get this down, then what's going to happen as we talk about the commandments is that you're just going to think about the commandments like most people think about any rule or any regulation. And, you know, how many of you are involved with the military? Right? Don't you guys have regulation books? Pretty strict, right? There's a code. You know what it is. It's black and white. They throw it on the table, right? And that's it. I mean, it is what it is. It's not really subject to your interpretation, right? You follow an order, and you just do it or you don't do it. And if you don't do it, and it's a really serious thing, you could get court-martialed, right? Okay, there are enough serious things you might not do. You might disobey an order or whatever. And you can get in a lot of trouble in the military. And that's necessary, isn't it? Because if everyone kind of just decided that freedom was this in the military, woo, let's just do whatever I want. You know, grunt, take that hill. I'll get to it. Can you imagine that? I just can't imagine that. Even like in a drill. Okay? Take that hill. Alright. I'll get to it. That's not the answer. The answer is yes, sir. Right? And you go. You know, I mean, it's amazing, you know, I mean, that kind of order. So even in the military, you would understand this. Freedom is not just doing whatever you want. You're really only free as a Marine to the degree that you follow the rules. Then you are free to do what you're supposed to do. Right? But again, these are lost concepts in society today. I bet you, if I went to public school or any school, for that matter, and I said, which definition of freedom do you think you like or you abide by? 99% of the people are up here. Guarantee you. Most people are like this. Here's freedom. Which begs another question, isn't it? And this is what I find absolutely admirable about those serving in uniform. You are fighting for freedom. Right? This country's at war for freedom, in principle. Which one is it? I wonder, which one is it? A or B? There's only two kinds. Either you can do whatever you want, or you can do what you want. It's supposed to be B. It's supposed to be B. I would not lay down my life for another man for this. Sorry. So just you can do whatever you want? I don't think so. That does not make you free. This I might do, so that you can have a chance to live as you should. Have an opportunity to have a life where you can enjoy the fruit of your labors with a just wage, with peace and security in your country, where your children can get an education, where your background isn't so much the way that you leads you to success. Hard work and ambition gives everybody a fair chance. See what I'm saying? But this is what we've taken with our freedom and turned it into. That's what it is now. Okay? And by the way, this is my 4th of July homily every year. Because I always ask, we're celebrating freedom today, great, what kind? And I hope our men and women in uniform know what kind of freedom they're fighting for, because I would surmise to say most of them don't understand this distinction. folks in the military agree with me? No? You think most people do?
A little bit different. Though very similar with freedom, constitution.
Right, but what does the Constitution give you?
Sure,
this?
Sure, I mean, I'm with you, but there is a fine distinction that we don't, I'm not defending either one of those, I'm defending the Constitution, and then that's your interpretation of...
Oh, that's not my interpretation.
Well, I'm not defending the people of America.
Gotcha.
Either one of those. I'm defending the Constitution, which allows.
Okay, hold on. Wait. Okay. But let me take one step forward then. The Constitution is an expression of this.
Right.
That's what the Constitution is.
Right.
It's not an expression of this. Okay, so then you are defending this. I mean, if I back up before the Constitution, when we just say this, the Constitution is one expression in law of this. Because other countries have constitutions too, right? And they're also technically free countries too, right? Okay, so and we respect our allies. I mean, they have their own versions of democracies, right? Okay, so this is what you're defending. Okay. Now, but do you think most of your peers know that? I mean, in other words, see, you and I just made a leap in agreement here that this is what the Constitution is an expression of. I'm just curious. I mean, it's not important to more theology.
So, I mean, I think even in this country, you have
sure.
So that's, I think, the difference between because most people are divided that way. Most people in the military consciously or subconsciously abide by being.
Oh, that's good to know.
We're defending the Constitution.
You know, on that note, I can tell you that I work at the Marine Corps University on the base.
Mm-hmm.
We just had Justice Scalia about
Scalia.
Come and give us an awesome lecture on the Constitution. And it all lines up to
right. B versus A.
Right.
Okay.
And so he's in an auditorium full of hundreds of military.
Sure.
Air Force, Navy.
So it's a friendly environment. Yeah. It's not CNN, ABC, and CBS's board of directors in each of the rows.
But I guess my point is, from my perspective, officer level, professional military education, like you said, Marine, take the hill. We get that. And I think that most people in there
get good. Well, thank goodness. Because if that weren't the case, I'd be really nervous. I hope you would be too. You know, guys didn't get that. Okay, good. Well, that's good to know. Right. Now, so let's get on to the Ten Commandments. I just want you to understand these notions of freedom and the law before we get to it. But I think that's a good example in the military, since we have a community here that has many people in the military. Okay, so the Ten Commandments, again, as I said, form the foundation floor. This is actually just the bottom minimal thing, okay? So let's go to the Ten Commandments. Here's the first. This is all from the book of Exodus. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. Okay? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Now, I just want to line up the Ten Commandments just as a group for a second here, because this might be a very helpful dichotomy. Okay. Now, remember when Jesus is asked, Master, what are the two great commandments? He says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Right? These are the two great commandments. What Jesus is doing is he's summarizing the Ten Commandments. All right? So the first one is, you shall love the Lord your God with all of yourself. Okay? All right. Then the second one is not to take the name of the Lord in vain. And then this is the third, to keep holy the Sabbath. That's what we're going to talk about today. Just these three. Now, keep in mind that the commandments are not a random listing of commandments. When I teach the Ten Commandments to the grade school kids, I say, okay, we're going to learn the Ten Commandments today, and next week we're going to have a quiz, an area of much contention in the school, Father Magat's infamous quizzes. And I tell them very simply, the quiz is exactly what I'm going to write on the board. All you have to do is regurgitate the Ten Commandments. You don't have to analyze them. You don't have to tell me what they mean. You just have to be able to spell the words correctly and tell me what they are. And what do they always say? In order? Yes, in order. Okay? Now, let's talk about, we talked about the Constitution for a second, you mentioned that. Let's talk about foundational documents of this country, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You can't have liberty and you can't have the pursuit of happiness unless you first have life. No life, the other two, irrelevant, really. You can't talk about them, really. Okay? And you can't really have happiness without liberty. You need to have the capacity to do what you ought in order so you can be happy. Okay? So, even the founders, they were all classically trained. They all knew the hierarchy. And this is precisely the hierarchy that God gives us. Interestingly, right, this is thou shalt not kill. This is not the first of the commandments regarding your neighbor. This is honor your father and your mother. Isn't that interesting? Even before homicide, you better get your home life in order. Okay? This one. Adultery. This is coveting your neighbor's wife. This is your neighbor's goods. Okay, this is lying. You shall not bear false witness. This is stealing. Okay, so we're going to look at this in the second half next week, but today we're just going to stay on the left side here. Loving the Lord your God with all your mind, heart, and soul, not taking the name of the Lord in vain, and keeping holy the Sabbath. Those are the Ten Commandments right there. Left side, first three, God. Just God. Now, why is this important? Because, especially for you Catholics, and soon to be Catholics, when you're preparing your examination of conscience, your examination of conscience should be prepared in this order. That's the order God gives us. He gave us it in order. See, this is what happens a lot of times in people's examination of conscience. They think that as long as they stayed clear here and here, there are no mortal sins. If they haven't committed adultery or any of its forms, or they haven't coveted their neighbor's wife, no mortal sins. Right? So I might ask them, well, let's go back to the first three commandments. Have you been to Mass every Sunday? Ah, yeah, you know, here and there. Yeah, did you want to include that in your confession? See, because they're just worried about this. I mean, what, I go to the nursing home. And I always ask people to the nursing home when I'm there, would you like to go to confession? Because their grace is attached, you know, and in case they go, we want to have your confession heard before you die, right? I mean, you never know what that's going to be sometimes in the nursing home, right? What do they always say? Nah, Father, I'm too old to sin. What does that mean? I think I know what that means. Right? So, it's almost like this puritanicalism, right? And it's like, look, we're not Puritans here, okay? I mean, Catholics are really big on sex. It's fine. You can have sex just licitly. Okay? How do you think we get large Catholic families? Okay? I mean, we're very pro-life. All right? So, you know, but people think, oh, I'm too old to sin. Really? Then I start going, let's just stick with Commandments 1, 2, and 3. Oh, well, I haven't been doing a lot of that. In fact, my language is pretty bad. Ah, here we go. Okay, now we're getting somewhere. See what I'm saying? All right, so when you're doing your examination of conscience, start here. Start here. Everyone likes to start here, which tells me a lot that this isn't really at the forefront of your mind. If everything were well ordered, you'd always start here. I mean, I've gone to confession with my spiritual director when I first started with him, and he trained me to do this. And he said to me, hold on. Stop right there. He says, what about Commandments 1, 2, and 3? You had those down mastered perfectly? You love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind? Well, no. Well, why don't we talk about that for a second? Okay? That's where we got to start. I mean, if we could get number 1 down, all the rest kind of fall in place. If I love the Lord my God with all my heart, mind, and soul. Now, some people might say, well, Father, doesn't that really only apply to people who are priests and religious? Because, I mean, how can I have to love my wife, I have to love my children. Okay, Love the Lord your God with all your mind, heart, and soul, proper to your vocation, within your state of life. Yes, I know you can't love God undividedly, because even St. Paul concedes in his letters that the married man is divided between pleasing his wife and pleasing the Lord. Okay? That's true. So the idea here is, are you loving the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, proper to your vocation, in proportion to your state of life? This is why, for example, I remember one time, I was in a perpetual adoration chapel. Some of you know what that is. That's a chapel, we have four of them in our diocese, where we put the Blessed Sacrament, the Eucharist, in a special vessel, an instrument called a monstrance, from the Latin word monstrare. We put the host, and it's a very, sometimes, ornate, it looks like a sunflower, okay? And we put the Blessed Sacrament in there for, it's called exposition, it's to expose our Lord. And he is there in the church here on First Fridays, we do this until the morning mass. He's there exposed for us to adore him. It is punctuating or highlighting the highlight of the Mass, which is a consecration. Okay, but it's not the consecration, because that already happened. Our Lord, once the bread and wine are changed into his body, blood, soul, and divinity, it persists in that state until it is no longer visibly or physically present as such. So, we have the Blessed Sacrament exposed, and there are some churches, or four parishes of our 70 in the diocese, in different parts of the diocese, where the parish has someone, at least two people, adoring the Blessed Sacrament 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Okay, so they all take an hour. Right? And it's called a Perpetual Adoration Society. And each hour has a captain, and the captain has teammates, team members. And the captain assigns team members. You're covering this week, you're covering next week. Right? And they have certain rules, like for example, women are not supposed to be there alone between the hours of like 10 o'clock and 6 in the morning. Right? Because, you know, there are two women in the chapel alone and some stranger comes in and can wreak havoc. It could be a pretty bad situation. Men only in those hours. Except things like that, okay? So one day, I walked into a Perpetual Adoration Chapel to pray. It's always open. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's always open. Jesus is there for me to adore him. So I go in and I'm kneeling down. And there's this woman kneeling next to me, and it's a Wednesday night or so, I know it's a school night, and it's about 11 at night. And she has her son sleeping on the floor next to her. Okay? Now he's maybe 7 at best. So we both left the chapel at the same time. There were other adorers there, of course. You never leave our Lord alone. And I left, and I said to her, excuse me, is that your son? She says, yes. Why are you here? She says, what do you mean? Well, isn't it a school? Doesn't he go to school? She says, what are you doing out at 11 at night in church? That's not your vocation to be here in church with your... But the commandment says to love the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, and mind. Proper, ma'am, to your vocation. God does not expect you to bring your 6-year-old son and make him sleep on the ground so you can pray. Pray at home. You're not supposed to be home. See what I'm saying? But she had taken this law and stretched it out beyond its logical conclusion. It's not logical for her out to be at 11 at night with a 6-year-old son under the guise of, no, I'm loving, I'm following the commandment. Ergo, those who don't bring their children at all hours of the night are not. Uh-uh. Proper to your vocation. You got to stay within the bounds of what is proper to a healthy childhood for your son. Well, anyway, she thought I was heretical, but never mind. Okay, so, all right. So, let's talk about the first commandment. You shall love the Lord your God with all your mind, heart, and soul. Okay, so it's the literal term. The little terms are heart, soul, and mind. Okay, now, listen to some of these sins in an examination of conscience. Okay? All right. One, do I love God above all things? Have I doubted God's love for me? Have I doubted God's ability to forgive me? Have I doubted God's desire for my salvation? Have I presumed my salvation? Have I failed to orient my life and activities toward God, who is my creator and redeemer? Do I profess to be Christian, yet live as if there were no God? Have I denied God's existence? Have I been superstitious in believing horoscopes, reincarnation, tarot cards, crystal power, or fortune tellers? Have I taken part in seances, used a Ouija board, or taken part in pagan rituals? Have I professed another religion? Do I belong to groups opposed to the Catholic faith, such as the Masons, Planned Parenthood, We Are Church, Women's Ordination Conference, Catholics for a Free Choice, Call to Action, Pope St. Pius X Society, and others? Okay, now, let's go back to the original commandment. Our CYO director, Jillian Ramsell, made a very good observation to me. Do you know how many pages, just take a guess, guys, how many pages of the catechism are devoted to the Ten Commandments? Take a guess. How many pages, now I'll just say how many pages are in this volume, how many pages, let's see, of the, it's a lot, I don't even know how many pages this volume is, but let's see here. Of the 680 plus pages of the catechism, how many are devoted to the Ten Commandments? 150. Of almost 700. That's a pretty good chunk, isn't it? 150 out of 700 pages. This entire Catholic faith, 150 pages are devoted to the Ten Commandments. She was mentioning to me the other day that the CYO kids, our kids in our Catholic youth organization, she was talking to them, and she was asking them about the Ten Commandments. And for the first commandment, they said, well, I mean, as long as I'm not worshiping, like, you know, some weird gods or like the moon or the stars, I'm probably not committing anything against the first commandment. Okay, did you notice that if you took that, that would leave you half a page for commandment one? Okay, the first commandment in the catechism is a whopping 7 pages. Okay? You see the reductionist model that a lot of people have? Or how about taking the Lord's name in vain? As long as I don't see GD, that's it. We'll see about that. Okay? Or keeping holy the Sabbath. Well, as long as I don't go shopping on Sundays or do something holy, it's okay. As long as I don't miss Mass. Well, according to the Catholic Church, we got a lot more than just not missing Mass. Okay, there's a lot more to it. Okay, so let's get down to it. Now, here we are. First commandment. Let's take sins against the virtues of faith, hope, and charity. First, faith. Voluntary doubt. Disregards or refuses to hold as true what God has revealed and the Church proposes for belief. Okay? So that's voluntary doubt. Now, involuntary doubt refers to hesitation in believing, difficulty in overcoming objections connected with the faith, or also anxiety aroused by its difficulty in understanding. Okay, involuntary doubt's a lot different than voluntary doubt. Voluntary doubt says, the Church teaches that the Eucharist is the body and blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. I disagree. That's voluntary doubt. Involuntary doubt, which is fine, that means it's struggling. That's not true doubt. True doubt's voluntary doubt. Involuntary doubt would be like this. We as Catholics are supposed to believe that the Eucharist is the body and blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. I just have a difficulty fathoming how that could possibly be. Not that I don't believe it could be true, it's just that how does it change substance without changing appearances? See the difference? That's a person who's struggling, they're trying to grasp the faith. And really, every Catholic should be in some form of involuntary doubt. It's not true doubt as in obstinance or hardness. It's like almost an awe, or like, gosh, I thought I was pretty smart. I don't get that. It's okay. That's called a mystery. It's intended to be obscure insofar as it always pulls you to deeper faith. And if you know, think about our faith for a second. I hope all the persons who are neophytes would subscribe to this statement. The Catholic faith is not unreasonable. In fact, it's quite reasonable. Yes, there may be things that you say are, oof, that's a tough one to understand. Fine, it's okay, don't worry. We've been trying to figure it out for 2,000 years, and we don't think we're going to get an answer, by the way, in this life. I mean, eventually they're only known in the face of God. It's okay, don't worry. We don't have the hubris of thinking that we can finally figure this out. But if you think about it, right? I mean, all of us, in a certain sense, should be struggling with the articles of the faith. Not in real doubt, but we should be struggling to try to understand them better, to penetrate. And God gives us the gifts of the Holy Spirit in order to do that. Okay? How about this? Sins against hope. Despair. By despair, man ceases to hope for his personal salvation from God, for help in attaining it, or for the forgiveness of sins. Despair is contrary to God's goodness, to his justice, for the Lord is faithful to his promises and to his mercy. Okay, this is a very, very common sin, despair. I cannot be saved. I cannot be loved. My sins are so bad, they are unforgivable. I have committed sins that are beyond God's mercy. Anytime someone does that, what they are implicitly doing is rendering the crucifixion, the redemption of the human race, a little bit impotent. It wasn't meritorious enough to overcome even that sin that you think is so unforgivable. Or, there is no hope in my life. I am at wit's end. Now, let's make a very important distinction here. I want to make that distinction between someone who's suffering from what I'd call clinical depression. Okay? Someone who's diagnosed with clinical depression, which is a legitimate psychological condition, may not be in despair. Alright? In other words, they may have lost the capacity to exercise the virtue of hope because of a psychological condition. See what I'm saying? Alright, and there are lots of people, I mean, depression is very common in the West. Oh my goodness. Alright, it's very common. Especially this time of year, seasonal affective disorder, right? And then you have the holidays coming and people get depressed, you know, for various reasons, okay? Understandable. All right. I'm not talking about depression here. That's psychological. I'm talking about something spiritual, despair. This is a person, see, because a person who might be depressed might still have hope that somehow, in spite of it all, God can save them. That there is a better life beyond this one. That there has to be something beyond my wildest imaginings that awaits me, regardless of how much I suffer in this life. See what I'm saying? I mean, that's at the end of the day, if you think about it, the deathbed is the great equalizer in the world. No matter how rich you are or how poor you are, you put two men next to each other on their deathbed, they are the same. Except for how they have lived their life leading to that point. You see? Death comes for us all. So, it's important to distinguish between clinical depression and despair. Any questions about that so far? No? Okay. Charity. This is against God's love. Alright? Here's a few things. One, indifference. Indifference neglects or refuses to reflect on divine charity. It fails to consider divine goodness and its power. Right? Second is ingratitude. Should be pretty clear. Third, lukewarmness. Lukewarmness is hesitation or negligence in responding to divine love. It can imply refusal to give oneself over to the promptings of charity. Right? Acedia, or spiritual sloth, or laziness, goes so far as to refuse the joy that comes from God and to be repelled by divine goodness. It refuses the joy that comes from God and to be repelled by divine goodness. This is sometimes the case with when I work with the youth. It's not cool to love Jesus. Right? This is why, by the way, Pope John Paul II started World Youth Day. Right? because he wanted to give the Catholic youth of the world an opportunity to openly express their faith, because most of them live in parts of the world and societies where it is not cool to do that. So they made being Catholic cool. World Youth Day, has anyone ever been to World Youth Day? I mean, that thing is like amazing. And wouldn't you agree? I mean, it doesn't, I mean, it doesn't give you a lot of hope in the world, in the sense that you can't believe that all these young people are singing and, you know, and they're just really, they're praising the Lord, and they go to confession in droves. I mean, like you've never seen before. They're kneeling in front of the Eucharist. Some of them are going to communion for the first time since their first communion. You know, they're going to confession for the first time since their first communion. I mean, it's an amazing conversion experience for a lot of these people. And to me, one of the most really compelling ones was, I think it was in, actually it was in World Youth Day, but it was Pope John Paul II's visit to St. Louis in, I think it was 95. He came to St. Louis in 1995, St. Louis, Missouri. And it was such an amazing sight. He went to, I think it's called the Kiel Center, K-I-E-L. That's, I think, their hockey arena. I think it was for the St. Louis Blues play. And Pope John Paul II, when he walked into that stadium, much like when Pope Benedict came to Nationals Park, you thought a rock star had shown up. I mean, people were going berserk. And the one in the Kiel Center in St. Louis was all kids, maybe from the ages of like 10, maybe till like 22, okay? And just going wild. And Pope John Paul II had a cane. He's drooling. I mean, he doesn't really have all the zip and pizzazz that a well-manufactured, marketed Britney Spears does. Okay, you see what I'm saying? What a juxtaposition. You know, just total different worlds, right? But the kids are going crazy, and he would just say a few things that were understandable, and what little they could understand, when he would stop, they'd all give him a standing ovation. You know, and so, you know, this acedia is a desire to refuse the joy that comes from God. And then last is hatred of God. Now, I want to mention also, too, another associated sin with this. It's called religious indifferentism. Does anyone know what that is? Religious indifferentism. All religions are the same. It doesn't matter what religion you are. It's all good. At least you love Jesus. It's all God. Okay, that's bunk. Don't tell that to St. Thomas More, the patron saint of our diocese. All religions are the same. Anyone know the story of St. Thomas More? St. Thomas More was Lord Chancellor of the realm of England, 1530s. Okay? Third highest man in the British Empire. He refused to sign the Act of Supremacy, declaring King Henry VIII as the supreme liege of the Church of England. He refused. He remained silent. Okay? Folks up the hill, their whole religion is based on this whole event in history. Okay? King Henry VIII would not accept Thomas More's silence as assent to the oath of supremacy. Now, isn't that interesting? Because in British common law and in American civil law, silence does mean assent. See what a perverted time it was? It was even violating the very principles of English common law. Silence is assent. If you don't say anything, the presumption is you agree with what is happening. Thomas just wanted to be quiet. His office was stripped of him. He languished in the Tower of London for 2 years and was finally beheaded. He could have become an Anglican, but he chose to die for his Catholic faith. Now, when you hear the asinine comment that all religions are the same, and it doesn't matter, ask Thomas More. He died a martyr because all religions aren't the same. And this is very common in our time today, you know. And it just doesn't matter what religion you profess. It's all good. We're all going to heaven. That's actually the sin of presumption, that we're all going to heaven. We don't know that. Okay? So, you know, it's not to say that we denigrate or downplay, but we should not denigrate other religions insofar as people have the right to choose whatever religion they choose to pursue. That's fine. But it does not mean that we have to give credence to the statement that all religions are the same. If they were the same, all Christians would also be Catholics. Right? All Christians would also be Catholics if all religions were the same. All religions are not the same. You can't tell me Episcopalianism and Catholicism are the same. They are not the same. They are different. Okay? And so I remember I got in trouble as a Navy chaplain because I was proselytizing. That's a big no-no in the code for chaplains in the armed services. You're not allowed to proselytize. That's why I left. Because I couldn't help myself. Okay? And my commanding officer kept on, he kept on punishing me, kept on disciplining me for proselytizing. And I said, and he's a priest. I said, Father, if we really believe we have the one true faith, let's roll the dice and see who wins. Who can make the best case? I'm willing to go toe-to-toe with anybody who wants to argue with me. Let's go toe-to-toe. Muslim, Jew, Protestant, I don't care. No. We don't want to do it. We need to be respectful. No, I respect their ability. I mean, they can believe what they want to believe, but if you're going to tell me that I can't push what I believe to be the gospel of Christ made known through his bride, the church, then you're asking me to deny a part of who I am. I can't not do that. Well, maybe this is not a good assignment for you. Agreed. See you later. Okay. That's end of my days with the military. Thank you very much. All right. Now. All right. Let's go on to the next commandment. Any other questions about that? There are a few more things you could say, but... here's some things. Superstition is a deviation of religious feeling and of the practices this feeling imposes. It can even affect the worship we offer the true God. So, for example, if you really believe what happened to you yesterday was because the fortune cookie at China Walk said so, we got some problems. Catholics don't believe in luck. When we say good luck all the time, sort of just nonchalantly, I think most Catholics who say good luck don't really believe in luck as such. Catholics believe in providence and grace. But it doesn't have the same ring to it, right? Good providence. Good grace. I'm hoping that's what people mean. Okay. Divination and magic, sorcery, going to tarot card readers, fortune tellers, it's tempting God. Here's another thing. Sacrilege, profaning or treating unworthily the sacraments and other liturgical actions. There's lots of sacrilege out there today, my gosh. Anybody remember Sinead O'Connor? Remember what she did at the picture of Pope John Paul II on Saturday Night Live? You guys remember that? For those of you who don't, she was singing a song as one of the acts at Saturday Night Live, and she took a picture of John Paul II and ripped it in two on national television. The next week, Joe Pesci was the host, and he began his monologue with the picture taped back together, right? And he says, because he had just done Goodfellas. Nobody messes with my Pope, and the whole place went wild. Okay, now, interestingly enough, I'm willing to bet that 90% of the people in that audience probably would reject what Pope John Paul II has to teach on sexual ethics, but they still found it indecent to denigrate the image of a person whom they generally regard, it was generally regarded in the world to stand for good and truth. See what I'm saying? I mean, it's such a paradox, I think, at times. I mean, the millions and millions of people, I mean, the Pope is the most photographed person in the world. He is. He's the most photographed person in the world. Bar none. And you know, George Bush, Bill Clinton, they don't drive the numbers. Even Barack Obama, Sarah Palin, they don't draw the numbers a Pope does. When the Pope shows up somewhere, your city's shut down, you're not going to work today, it ain't going to happen. Okay, unless it's a well-coordinated effort, well in advance. Okay, I mean, trust me, these governments do not like when big folks like the Pope come to town insofar as it really messes things up. Metro, traffic, I mean, they love the income and the revenue, but boy, the hassle, they almost think it's not worth it. Okay? But anyway, it's interesting, making fun of sacred persons, poking fun, I mean real fun as opposed to just teasing, about holy things and objects, happens all the time. And in fact, if you think about it, the last acceptable bias in the media is anti-Catholicism. about it, right? There's a movie coming out called Doubt, right? It's about a pedophile priest in the 1960s. Good timing, Christmas, right? Okay, let's say we had a movie like that about a rabbi or an imam. We'd be having some problems, wouldn't we? But it's okay if we do it for a Catholic priest. Okay, so let me tell you that we're the only ones doing our job. Okay, now, sacrilege. Simony. Well, simony, we got in a lot of trouble with Luther selling the sacraments. They're not for sale. All right. Now, the last thing I should just say about this one is this. I mentioned this on Monday, for those of you who were here. And by the way, I don't know if Father DiMartino has stressed this. If you are becoming Catholic this coming Easter, our expectation is that you're at Mass every Sunday and every holy day of obligation. You don't get to wait until you've been Catholic to be obliged. You should be coming now. You should be getting the habit of coming to Mass every Sunday, wherever you may be, and every holy day of obligation. Okay? And I'll guarantee you, the ones who do will stay with the faith. The ones who don't, less than a year after they become Catholic, they will no longer come to church. Happens every time. I've been doing this too long to know that to be the case. Okay. Jim, why, you remember this from Monday night? Why did it take 40 years for the Israelites to make it from Egypt to Israel across the Sinai Desert, a journey that takes no more than 7 days?
One generation died.
Right, actually plus 10 years. One generation is 30 years, right? 40 years. God wanted 40 years for the Israelites to be purified of their syncretistic ways, that is, combining their Egyptian religion and their Jewish religion together, like you see in the Caribbean in parts, combining Catholicism and voodoo, all in the same person. And God wanted a generation plus to be purified of those tendencies before they were worthy to enter the Holy Land across the Jordan. Pretty amazing, isn't it? It shouldn't have taken 40 years to get across the desert. Okay, it's funny, you know, in children's religions book, they trace the path, and, you know, I mean, the GPS would have been going nuts. You know, GPS had been constantly recalculating, you know, recalculating until 40 years pass. It's 40 years of recalculating, you know. So you're going down, and then you go across Egypt, okay, and then you're out of Cairo, okay, and then you're in the desert, and then there's just this circle and circle, and it's like this perpetual circle in the desert, and it says in the middle of 40 years. And then finally, after 40 years, it comes out on the other side, they entered into the Holy Land. You know, I mean,
they got lost at Sinai.
They got lost, all right. I mean, that's for sure. Okay, second commandment. The name of the Lord is holy. All right. Now, this is not just merely avoiding foul or vulgar language or blaspheming our Lord, our Lady, God Himself. It's using God's name disrespectfully. It's certainly using Him in a curse. It even includes withholding sins during a confession, although we could probably relegate that to lying by omission. Okay, but it's also the breaking of oaths that's included here too, although that could be relegated also to lying as well. All right, the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. But maybe just to say this about the second commandment. And by the way, if you're looking for what I'm looking at here, this is the Catechism 2142 to 2167. What I just want to say about the Lord's name is this. Recently, the Vatican banned lyrics, for those of you who are musicians, lyrics that contain this word. Okay? Remember this one, John? Alright, okay. Now, why is that? This is blasphemous for the Jews to write. That's why when they spell it, if they even spell it, this is how they spell it. They don't even put the vowels in. Not because Hebrew doesn't have vowels. It's because to say God's name is to express a familiarity with him which neither Jew nor Muslim believe is appropriate. Because unlike Christians who believe that God became man, suffered and died, and rose from the dead, and still maintains a sacramental yet real presence in our tabernacles in every Catholic church, for the Jews and the Muslims, God is so other, so distant, so beyond. I mean, if Muslims believed that the tabernacle contains the Eucharist, which contains the real presence of Christ, they would not be allowed in this zip code. Think about that. They would not be allowed in 22554 to live or to go into, because God is that holy. We are not to approach him with that kind of familiarity. But you see in the Catholic faith how different it is. We make God so accessible. I mean, we can receive communion twice a day. We can go every day, right? No problem. And yet for the Muslim, and certainly, so the Pope, in sensitivity to our Jewish brothers and sisters in God, said these lyrics are offensive to them. And we don't want to say anything that will offend their religion, because they are our forefathers in faith. You know, we are the children of Abraham in faith, not by lineage of blood. Obviously, we're not Jewish, unless some of you are, but most of us are not. Okay? So maybe the challenge out there in regards to keeping the Lord's name in vain is simply this. Do you notice for many people, just in common parlance, that the term GD is just pretty much just a normal part of how they speak? It's normative. It's normative. It's not even like they save it for exceptional cases. It's just normative. Right? And you might want to ask yourself, you know, if someone replaced God's name with your mother's name, okay, and then followed by the word damn, wouldn't you be a little offended? I would be. Okay? I'd be really offended if someone was taking my mom's name in vain, whether they knew her or not. I mean, it'd be really offensive to me. I'd say, excuse me. Okay? So the challenge is, if that's true for a human person, my mother, how much more so for God? Should be infinitely more so for God, without whom I wouldn't even have a mother, nor would I exist. So a good challenge, you know, is to challenge people on the use of that term, GD. Take them to task. You know, and you can use the same terms that are used, right? I'm sorry, that term really makes me feel uncomfortable. Because see, we live in the world where if you're uncomfortable, you've committed a sin. Okay? That's the world in which we live. That's really insensitive. Or you're not tolerant. Okay? So once you start accusing people of being intolerant of my love of God, and you're using him in a curse word, you really just made me feel uncomfortable. So you can use tolerance speak, tolerance language, and turn it right around on them. Right? They can, you know, and they feel free doing that, but if you poke fun at anything else about their religion, or anything about whatever, their sexual preference, for example, okay? Oh, you committed a mortal sin. You said that's against the natural law. Oh. You see what I'm saying? It's a perverted world. So a good challenge, perhaps, to take up people on the use of the Lord's name. I mean, if we're banning lyrics that contain this word, and we're using it respectfully, right, John? I mean, when we're singing that song, we're not disrespecting God. At least we don't intend to disrespect God. I mean, we're actually calling upon him. I mean, Augustine says, he who sings well prays twice. Not just he who sings, who he sings well prays twice. It's very important. That's why we have choirs. Okay? You know. But if we're doing this in hymnody to praise God, and this is considered offensive, then shouldn't that even raise the ante more on how much more offensive actually using his name as a curse would be? Man, I mean, in the Muslim world, those of you who are familiar with the Muslim world, you've been to the Holy Land, for example, different places of the Muslim world, oh, you better not do that to Allah's name. Uh-oh. You're going to get a little dagger in your gut if you do that with Allah's name. Okay, now, On the other hand, let's be clear, that's not the answer either. Okay, and that's fanaticism. Okay, that's not the way, I mean, you know, I'm not suggesting people go out there, Sean's going crazy back there, it's like, that's a great idea, Father. Let's all carry little, you know, survival knives and slash them up. Okay, no, that's not what I'm saying. That's not the answer either, but you see, I'm just to make the point that that's how zealous they are for God. And I admire that. I do, I mean, I don't agree with the way they deal with it sometimes. I mean, I think that's a little bit out of control too, but okay. All right, last thing about the Lord's Day. Sorry, I'm going over here a little bit. Actually, you know what, we'll save the Lord's Day for next week. Let me do that. Let me take a break here. We'll pick up with the third commandment, and then we'll go right into the other next commandments next week. Now, before you go, if you haven't gotten one of these, Will, please pass these out if you haven't done so. There are people who don't have them, I'm sure. This is the Telma. Just want to give you a quick explanation of this. And then those who want to take a break or need to give me things, if you have things due to me, like forms or letters or miscellaneous sheets of paper that I'm supposed to have for your file, this would be a good time to turn it in. You can walk up. Oh, and by the way, if you missed the roll call and you are here, like when I called roll and you are here, okay, you might want to come in and, Kay, you might want to come up here and sign your name, okay, among others. All right, some people walked in late, and I don't want to mark you absent if you were actually here. Just a minute past the time I called roll. Okay, now what you're all looking at is an image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, December 12th. The Blessed Virgin Mary appears in what is now Mexico City to a peasant named Juan Diego. That's his Christian name. His, Derek needs one over there. Can I have one too, please? Okay, Our Lady Guadalupe. That's fine. Our Lady Guadalupe. That's a tilma. Now, on December 12, 1531, the day of the last apparition, she asked Juan Diego to pick roses in the middle of December, which don't grow in December, Castilian roses, which don't grow in Mexico, and didn't at that time, from the hill called Tepeyac, which is now within the bounds of Mexico City. And she asked him to pick the roses and put it in the folds of his, poncho. He's wearing a poncho, you know what a poncho is, right? He's tucked in the folds of his poncho. The poncho is called a tilma. It was made out of cactus fiber. And he asked her to pick the roses and put them in the tilma and take the roses with him to the bishop, the Franciscan Bishop Zumarraga, and tell Bishop Zumarraga she means business, build a chapel here and hold processions in honor of me. After this point, Bishop Zumarraga dismissed this peasant as just some dreamer. And rightfully so. I mean, you know, if someone of little education to no education came forward and told you, there's this lady, and she tells me that you need to build a church here in the middle of really what was nowhere back then, okay, you might say, okay. So he goes, and he shows up to Bishop Zumarraga's residence, and what do you want? I have a message from the lady. All right, what does the lady want? You can see this going, right? And he says, here's the message. And he lets the roses fall out from his cloak. On the cloak, the Blessed Virgin Mary left this imprint, that image. Okay? It's on cactus fiber. Cactus fiber has a shelf life of about 7 years before it starts to deteriorate. This piece of cactus fiber has been in continual existence since 1531. Very excellent shelf life. Okay? It's a miraculous image. It's the only image we have of Mary that she gave us. Right, now, let's look at the Telma for a second. Before this event, the Franciscans were having a doggone hard time converting the native Mexicans, who are really from Aztec background, because they kept on presenting images of the saints and Jesus that were unfamiliar to them. They were all European looking. And they said, I don't really think it's a good idea to get in with this European religion because they've brought nothing but smallpox and other problems. No, that's not the only thing they brought, but they brought technology and they brought order, but and they also stopped human sacrifices, but that's another story. Just to give you an idea of how satanic Aztec culture was in the time of Our Lady Guadalupe, in one 14-day period, they conducted 80,000 human sacrifices for the rededication of one of their temples, a pyramid in Mexico City. So for all the nostalgia that so many Mexicans have for Aztec culture, they somehow forget to be reminded that it was essentially a religion based in Satanism. Men, women, and children, didn't matter, 80,000 people were brought up on a hill one by one, stuck over a slab of marble, and with a hot, sharp stone, had their chest cut open and their heart pulled out and eaten by the priest. 80,000. Now, just to give you a scale, if anyone's been to FedEx Field, that holds 90,000. So just take about three or four sections of the 400 level, and that's how many people died. That's a lot of people. Okay. So the Blessed Mother appears not as a European-looking person, but as an Aztec queen. Interesting. Okay. Now, let's just mention a few facts about the image, because it's miraculous. The first thing is her eye, her left eye. If you do a, if you put the left eye under a microscope, you will see very clearly in the eye the exact scene that Mary was looking at when St. Juan Diego appeared to came to Bishop Zumarraga's house. So you can see in her eye. You know, so like for example, right now, if you look really closely in my eye, I'm looking right at Cindy, and Will is on the periphery, okay? Looking right at Cindy, if you look at my eye, you would see a reflection of Cindy upside down. Okay, that's how that works. Okay, so that was what they would see in her eye. Bishop Zumarraga and members of his household. Right? Pretty interesting, isn't it? All right. Now, this is the only image of Our Lady where she's pregnant. Now, how do we know that? Physiologists have done studies on the position of her shoulders relative to her feet and her torso. Her shoulders are cast in a way that it's clear she's bearing child. She's not just leaning over, but she's actually bearing a child under that cloak. Now, if you look at her cape over her head and around her shoulders, you see there's stars on it. If you open that up and laid it flat, that was the exact position of the stars in Mexico City by constellation on December 12, 1531. And if you look at her dress, you see there are little lines in her dress. If you open that up flat, that would actually give an outline of the topographical map, including mountain ranges and valleys and rivers in the entire country of Mexico. Pretty amazing, huh? Okay, now, you see the little angel below? He's holding one hand on her cape and one hand on her dress. Aztecs always understood religious art sideways. Not up and down like we do, but sideways. Okay? So the angel is holding in one hand heaven and the other hand earth. She's the queen of heaven and earth. That's what that told them. Now, the other most important thing about the tilma, which is very little known, but it's true, the tilma has its own temperature. It maintains its own temperature, 98.7 degrees. The case in which it's held for adoration and veneration is 72 degrees. The tilma is 98.7 degrees all the time. They test it every so often. She's still don't have a fever, and she's feeling fine. Okay? And, by the way, in the original version, this is black and white. Their cape is made out of that turquoise blue. If you lay two things about, one, that shade of blue was not available in the world to to be manufactured at that time. Okay? And that color blue had never been seen before. In terms of like, you know, oils and acrylic, whatever they had, they probably didn't have acrylics, but just oils, oil-based painting, okay? That blue was not found anywhere. No one had ever seen that shade of blue. The other thing too, like the Shroud of Turin, which many believe to be the shroud that held Christ's body in the tomb. If you lay the tilma flat and you take one of those x-ray machines and a microscope, like electron microscope, the tilma doesn't have the image painted on top. It's like seared into the surface. When you hold it, it's perfectly flat. So it's not like, you know, like for example, even on this piece of paper, I've written something on it. If you took an electron microscope, you could see the ink on top of the page, right? But in the tilma, the image is actually almost like it's x-rayed onto the image. Pretty amazing, huh? So there's Mass at 7:30. It's not a holy day of obligation, but you're more than welcome to come. We call it Guadalupalooza. And the Mass is at 7:30, and there's a procession at 7 around the complex. And we start at the Grotto of Our Lady Guadalupe, there in the corner of the property, and we're going to go around the property in procession, and we stop every so often, and the children of the community and others depict scenes from the various apparitions of Our Lady Guadalupe to St. Juan Diego, even to his uncle, St. Bernardino, who was sick, and the Blessed Mother healed him. And then finally, everything ends up going into the church for Mass at 7:30. Okay? And it's a great way to sort of get into the whole spirit of Guadalupe. She is, because she's pregnant, the patron saint of the pro-life movement as well, I should mention. Okay, why don't we stop there for a few minutes? Those who need to leave can. Sorry to keep you over. And those who want to stay for questions may do that as well. Oh, she's appearing in front of the sun. Yeah, and she's stepping on the moon. She's standing on the moon, but she's appearing in front of the sun, like she's eclipsing the sun. So she's bigger than the sun, standing on the moon. Oh, that's the moon.
Okay, that figure that comes
through. So she's standing on the moon, eclipsing the sun.
I was in San Antonio, Texas this weekend.
Oh,
saw a picture of that.
Yeah.
The depiction, that was not a moon.
What, that's like a horn?
Well, yeah, the depiction was a earring.
Was it a devil?
No. It was like a watermelon.
Oh.
And we looked at it and we're like,
that's probably not that. Yeah.
That's not right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's weird. Was it like an ice carving?
What's that?
Was it an ice carving or a painting?
No, it was a painting.
Oh, like almost like she's Carmen Miranda, that kind of thing? An idea? I don't
know. It was like bizarre.
Yeah. Do you have a picture of it?
Yeah, I can.
Next time.
Hello. Hi. What were you reading from?
Page 38.
38?
No. Oh, wait a minute.
Do I have the right book?
I don't know.
This is the one we got.
The very first one?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe I have a different printing. I'm sorry. It's
okay, I got really confused.
I couldn't.
Is that in here? Oh, sorry.
I turned to 38, I'm like...
Oops, sorry. I must have they've given you the wrong version. See, I must have a reprint. I'm sorry. Okay.
Me?
Yeah. Did you have the same problem, Crystal? Did you have the same problem?
Well, we were going to look all together.
No, oh, there's mine. You can have that one.
Oh, sure. Okay, thank you.
I do have some papers. My marriage thing and then my baptism.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Sweeney. Okay, God bless.